Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2805. Tonight we're going to have on Rob Maniscalco. He's from he's from South Carolina. And I think he may be on the line right now. I'm not sure. I'm going to check. Yes, he is. That's good. I'm glad to see that. But, okay. Rob, are you there? Hold on a second.
Yeah.
There you go. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. That's
can
cool.
You hear
Hold
me?
On a second. Yeah, I can hear you. Hold on a second. I'm opening
right.
I'm opening up mics here. Hold on a second. Okay, all right. All right. I'm glad you're here. I certainly want to hear your story, and I know there's a lot of other people that do as well. Now, but let me get the mission statement out of the way. I do read that on you know, when I do a show and so forth about NASCA, very important. And then I'll get back to you. And, again, I'm delighted that you're here, okay? Very happy you're here. So just hold on a second. Okay,
sure.
we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways, okay? That's what it is, two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And trust me, it does. Number two, offering hope for healing through our numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Now, our website is naasca.org. That's nasca.org. The reason why I mentioned also to our website, and, you know, Rob knows this. I know he's been all over the website, and he understands what this is. But there are people listening that don't understand this, so we have to explain a little something to them. If you go to our website, it really talks about NASCA, and there's all different categories and links that you can open, all right? It starts out with, you know, with programs, and it goes all the way across. There's all different things you can get into. And that's very good to have, all right? So you can learn a lot from our website. I use it all the time when I was doing a lot of presentations. Some schools are open again. Some are closed again. This is crazy. I'm in New Jersey. I don't have to say anymore. Okay? New Jersey is New Jersey. All right, whatever. So, you know, so the point is that I use it a lot myself, all right, when I do the presentations. Now, tonight, we have Rob Maniscalco on, and he's a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and he was abandoned by his mother when he was very young. Now, I'm not going to read his whole bio because Rob knows how the show goes. And, you know, he first starts out and he tells his story in a chronological manner, and, you know, age bracket, whatever, so people can follow it. And then we ask what you're doing today. So I am Carol Levine. I'm Vice President of NASCA, and I'm delighted to be here with you tonight, Rob, okay? And, hey, you can start telling your story right now. Go ahead.
Oh, hey. All right, Carol, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Just making sure everybody can hear me nice and clear, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Everything's fine.
Well, as Carol said, well, first let me just say thank you for NASCA. I appreciate what you're doing and what there are people out there like myself who are kind of outspoken, who have sort of, as you might call, say, come out of the closet, as it were, with their abuse story in the hopes of preventing future abuse, but also, as you said, to help people cope and recover. It's an ongoing process. I'm 61, so let me give you a little context. I've been a survivor for more than 50 years, and in that time, a lot of things have happened. And so we'll talk about what's happening now, as you said, later. But I'll go back and tell you the story, and I'll also frame it with the fact that, you know, everybody's story, some stories are so horrific that you can't even imagine how your story could even line up next to that, you know. But everybody's story, even if it's just a simple abuse of neglect or bullying, can have a huge impact on people, and everybody processes their abuse differently. So, having said that, my story starts when I was about, when I was about 9 months old, my mom abandoned me. And when, as you said, she left the household, and my father raised me pretty much single-handedly. And that sort of set the stage for me, naturally sensitive person that I kind of was, probably as a result of that neglect, kind of made me susceptible to grooming, which, of course, is the process an abuser uses to get you in into his lair, as it were. So being raised that way, kind of with my father, and being a little sensitive, I am an artist. This is my profession. I ended up being an artist and a writer and all that. You can see all that on the bio of, you know, who I am and what I do. But back when I was, you know, 10, 12 years old, I was very sensitive, wanted to be very special. I had this idea in my mind that I was going to become something really amazing, you know. This was in my head. And along comes my sister's boyfriend. She's in nursing school, and she is dating a doctor. Oh, my God, my nurse sister gets a doctor to ask her out, and he does, and they start going out and starts hanging out with the family. Sure enough, soon enough, he becomes very, very much a part of the family, coming to holidays and becoming part of our family dinners, and just kind of inveigled himself into our household. He was a man from originally from Brazil, a doctor, as I said, at radiology at the Children's Hospital in Detroit, where I grew up. Anyway, so he just became very interested in me, and I was very flattered that a man, of stature, of authority, a man who was learned, a doctor, you know, kind of picked up on what my sister was like in awe, and just couldn't believe that this guy wanted to date her. And, she also was the victim of this household where it was a bit chaotic, and because there wasn't any a woman running the show, so she was sort of like the mother of the house and was just happy as heck to have somebody interested in her. So he would take me out for ice cream, take the family out, we'd go do things together, all, like I said, the holidays. And he came up with the idea that wouldn't it be great if me and him could spend a weekend together and just do man stuff, guy stuff. And I kind of there was a little voice in my head saying, you know, I don't know if that's such a good idea. And, of course, at 14, and I had to really stress this, it took me a while to even seek therapy. It was mid-20s, late-20s before I even realized there was something going on here out of the ordinary. But I felt this. But my sensibilities, my spider senses, as it were, at 14 are not fully developed. At 14, you can't make adult decisions about who you want to have sex with and what when it's right and what's a good way to go. It's just not possible. Now, I have two kids that are 16 and 8 and 17, almost 18 now, and I'll tell you their stories as well because they kind of tie in. Because this is generational. This goes on and on. Anyway, so I agreed to go with him. He picks me up from the hospital. He's wearing his white coat, and everybody's all excited for us to go out and have this guy thing, and I'm feeling in the back of my mind, I'm not sure if this is a good idea, but, you know, I think there was some part of me that felt like this was fake. And this is, you know, these are the thoughts that teenage kids have. They're not real. They're based on TV and things like that, the imagery that you get. So, you know what I mean? When you're that age, you don't have the ability to have good judgment. So
no, you don't.
I don't feel the need to justify it. But I know that guilt and justification is a huge factor in at least it's been in my recovery. Because, you know, maybe if I had only thought, you know, like I say, when it comes to trauma, it's like, if only I had seen the writing on the wall. Well, anyway, so ago he takes me out to an Italian restaurant. He tells the waiter I can drink wine. Well, you can't do that, sir. Well, I'm a doctor. And he was, you know, he's flaunting his authority and his learnedness, and all the while telling me how wonderful a person I am and how talented I am and how so passionate and so full of life. I can almost hear his very Latino accent, you know, talking to me like this, and he was very seductive, and he was very good looking and very very persuasive, and obviously so. That was all fun and games and ha-ha, but then we went back to his apartment, and I walked in, and I turned around, and he had deadbolted the lock and had the key in his put the key in his pocket. And
oh,
I just remember that moment of seeing that and knowing, oh, this is not like a TV show. This is not some kind of a game. This isn't like a dare or a test or a... it's real, and I just suddenly realized that I was kind of in for something that I didn't want, and he just proceeded to, you know, get me drinking. We smoked weed, and we're just hanging around on the sofa, and you know, he starts taking off my shirt, and I'm feeling uncomfortable and kind of wiggling around to try to. And he just kind of kept going, and needless to say, he got me, took me into his bedroom, and basically he sodomized me and performed fellatio and all the things you can imagine that were terrible. And for me, I had this, I describe it as an out-of-body experience. I literally dissociated at that moment. Where he entered me, I just left my body, and I could see from above what was happening to this person, this body. And it really, you know, when you have that kind of experience and you leave your body, you know, people say, oh, I had an out-of-body experience. It's devastating to leave your body because, you know, you don't want it, you can't come back once you've left it. And I just, you know, cooperated as best I could at that point and wriggled out and went into the bathroom. And then I don't really even know what happened the rest of the evening. I don't know, the next day he was hallucinating and talking to the wall and, you know, talking about how he could call the Pope if he wanted to and talk to him. And he was quite delusional. And, you know, I didn't know that part of him, but, you know, you could see he was not happy with the way things went. And I was just biding my time, anything I could think of to just get back home. And when I did go home, he finally took me home the next day or the day after. I can't remember. I tried in therapy to kind of piece together the rest of the weekend, but I did come home. I didn't speak for, you know, a week. I didn't say a word to anybody. My father kind of suspected there was something going on. Didn't know how to approach me. My brother, I think, older brother, approached me, and I told him what had happened, and then my father intervened. And to make the situation really horrible in a way, my father decided to confront this guy. So he and my sister and I went in a car to this guy's apartment, the same apartment where I was sodomized, and we sat there, and he in the other room, in the kitchen, he was mouthing, "I'm going to kill you." And this is all while my father and my sister are sitting on the couch. And it was devastating. And then he would call me for weeks after this. He'd call me on the phone in the middle of the night and talk to me, and I'd hang up and call me back, and but nobody intervened and said, "Hey, you know, cut the phone off. You can't." You know, it just was, and I can only imagine how easy it is nowadays to communicate with your, you know, the victim with the perpetrator. That must be so difficult to try to alleviate that problem. So this went on for, you know, months, and my father decided not to press charges because he was a portrait painter and didn't want to offend the establishment there at the medical school. And so he just thought it would be better off we just brush it under the rug.
Oh,
and, you know, I started getting headaches and reacting in physical ways with hives and hemorrhoids. And throughout my teen years, I had a headache that just didn't go away. So, and they didn't know to get me help. They didn't know to actually get a therapist or anything like that. Because this was a long time ago. This was back in the 70s. And this stuff wasn't even talked about.
No.
But anyway, so to make a long story short, sorry for elongating this, but so he got away scot-free. There was no retribution, no consequences. And I to this day wonder, you know, if he went on to perpetrate with other people. And of course the answer is probably a certain yes. He didn't, nothing stopped him. I imagine he may have tripped up and got caught. And so in my mid-20s, early 30s, I decided to try to locate him. And of course that was difficult to do back in, you know, the 80s and stuff. And I never did. So I wrote a book about what if I had found him, could locate him and confront him with a gun. And so the book is about me seeking him out and finding him and having this moment with him with a gun in my hand. What would you do? What would I have done? And I won't ruin the book by telling you how how it ends.
I know what I would have done. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I had a therapist who said, "I think you should write an alternative ending," because they weren't happy with the ending I came up with. But I came up with an ending that was more in line with my moral values that I came up with, or I developed, the ones that I aligned myself with, which is, you know, there's a place in hell for him, but I'm not here. I can't judge. I certainly couldn't. I could never live with myself if I had the ability to kill another human being. I don't care who they are. We have a justice system that is flawed, but that's what it's for, to, you know, get people like that off the street. Anyway, I never did find him, and so I've been in and out of therapy all my life. I've done many different kinds of therapies. I was into the primal therapy in the 90s in New York City when I lived there, you know, where you scream and yell on throw things, hit things. It was really very intense. But all that did was exacerbate the anger and the feelings of helplessness. So, you know, they've come a long way in the psychological field, and they don't really do that sort of thing anymore. And I think that's right. But I've done EMDR lately with the hand, you know, the hand, the movement of the hand, and telling the story over and over again with exposure therapy. You know, as I'm telling you the story, I'm practicing what I learned, which is, you know, when I'm telling the story or when I'm triggered, there are many ways I've come up with to keep myself grounded and not go, you know, off the deep end emotionally. My SUDs, you know what SUDs are?
I've heard of that, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, just your emotional responses to trauma and to being triggered, and to be able to lessen those and to, you know, not let it infiltrate your life and ruin it, you know.
Right.
Now, with two kids, go ahead. You got a question or?
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you. I'll tell you what. One thing that, well, I very much believe, okay, and also two other people, you know, other people in NASCA, we don't want it to define our life, or, you know what I'm saying, what happened to us, and if you can help it, all right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's because there is life after abuse. There absolutely is. But we get on to our healing journey, and, you know, it's a long process. It's not anything that happens overnight, all right? We have to deal with all different kinds of things. I had terrible panic attacks, and I couldn't deal with life, so I started to drink, and I got into drugs. Let me ask you something. Did you ever get into drugs or alcohol?
No, I haven't really abused drugs and alcohol, or even used them for that. I make a point, you know, to not get high when I work, you know, on my art or whatever, when I'm doing things that are serious and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
I've been disciplined enough in that area, but that's not to say I haven't developed some addictions. I'm addicted to thoughts. The thought of no matter what.
Oh, thoughts. Okay, yeah. I am having a little trouble hearing you. Can you hold on a second? I am having a little problem hearing you. Do you have your speaker on or something?
Yes.
Maybe you better turn it off.
You want me to not turn the speaker on? Okay.
Yeah, that, I think that's going to be better. Yeah, I think so. Go ahead. You said thoughts, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thought addictions. No, the thought of that. I'm not good enough. No matter what I do, it's inevitably going to end in failure. This was a thought that, you know, came directly as a result of the abuse, the grooming, because I associated all the good things that he was saying, all those affirmations that we do and that we learn in therapy. He was using those. And can you imagine having affirmations be a trigger? That's what they are. I mean, people who are grooming you are really setting you up for a really difficult time, because all the things that are supposed to make people feel better actually make me feel worse. So, you know, I've had to rework the whole affirmation thing to make it possible for me to use them properly, you know, in a way that actually works. Because, I mean, I don't believe that I'm good enough. And how many times I say it, it's not going to make it better. So I have to, you know, I had to give it all to God. And my solution was let God take the brunt of this, you know, this was his promise, his commitment. He is the ultimate authority, and his authority is not going to be used to manipulate or harm me. And that, this is something I just put my trust in. So that's an important thing for my affirmations. It's not my voice saying those things. It's God saying that to me.
I do that too.
Good enough, but God thinks I'm good enough. And those voices that we hear in our head, that when we're, you know, doing these affirmations, that's God. So I've just attributed those that thought in my mind, those positive affirmations, you know, that I'm learning and I'm getting better and that I can do this and it's possible for this to happen. That kind of thing. Those sort of things are happening. And you know, I just find it. I couldn't do it myself. So that's important to kind of be able to recognize that we can't do this alone, and we need support. We need help. We need our peers. I never even met a fellow male sexual abuse survivor, until I was a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show during that show they had with male survivors.
Wasn't it 200 men or something or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the Oprah 200, and we still have a little group on Facebook and kind of talk to each other. But there was this, in a room full of men who had a similar experience, some of them horrific. That was pretty enlightening. I mean, I didn't even know what the trigger was. You know, I learned a lot about coping just doing that show. So I would suggest anybody
to
get a hold of
those, stop
go watch those.
Mm-hmm. Let me stop you for a second here, because I want to talk a little bit about this. You see, you're doing a fine job, by the way. You are doing a fine job.
Thank you.
Yes, you are. And I just want to say a little something here,
Carol.
Because, you know, I was attacked, assaulted sexually many times in my life. Okay, well, I'm not going to go into specifics. There's many times by many different people, okay? And only one was taken before the courts because you said you were looking for him and all this other stuff. Well, I was one of 14 in Staten Island. And where this monster, and I call them monsters, was looking for little girls, and I was one. And quite frankly, he only got 3 years in jail. That's it.
Yeah.
And that blew me away.
14? There were 14 people that he assaulted?
14. I was number 14. And he only received a three-year jail sentence. That's it. And let me tell you something. His wife petitioned the court, okay, and she was claiming that there was all kinds of problems at home. She couldn't make him enough money. They had children. I often wondered if he touched them. And he had a little girl, and she was my age. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? And So he did a year and a half. That's it.
Oh.
So you see, when you mentioned before about
the system isn't working so well for people like us.
Right, exactly. Okay. You're talking to someone here. You're speaking to me. I don't know if you ever heard me before on radio. A lot of people know me. I'm the nut. I'm the one that likes to clown around and all this other stuff. But I can get dead serious, too, you know. And I like to mix, you know, a little bit of humor in, too, because, you know, when things are so heavy and so gloomy, and that's what it is, sexual assault, sexual, physical, mental, emotional, neglect, it doesn't matter what it is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people have forgotten how to laugh. They can't laugh because they're so wounded, okay, wounded.
Yep.
And so when you can get to the point in your life where you can laugh at things, you have humor and all this other stuff, then you're in a better place.
It's funny
you
mention that because I was the class clown and the class flirt. It was in the yearbook. I was the joker of the class, and you know, and in my one of my responses was to you know to make everybody laugh, and I found my humor was very sardonic and very could be very biting, and it kind of I have had a hard time really keeping friends just because I find a darker humor than a lot of people do in what might seem otherwise innocent. This was the worst part of the abuse at the end for me was that it stole my innocence. You know, you cannot see things innocently. You can't see. I mean, I look at people who maybe are on the spectrum, like we were watching this Love on the Spectrum, and they have no guile. They're just absolutely in love. It's such a beautiful day, you know. It's like,
oh,
I just wish I could have that kind
of,
I wish I could have that kind of light. And
right.
So I laugh. I have a lot of fun. I get people, you know, write comedy, and, you know, I'm pretty good at it. But it's a cover though in a way among others you know some people use alcohol or I use the humor to cover some of the hurt and you know it's not really quite so covered if it's coming out like it sometimes can you know.
Well, you know, I'll tell you I was a class clown too, okay, a lot of times.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I still to this day, though, I've gotten to the point where my humor, see, I was like sarcastic. I had the dark humor like you're talking about. I come from a family that has dark humor. I know what you're talking about, all right? So, but I've gotten to the point in my life, finally, you know, where I can be funny as heck without being sarcastic, rude, crude, whatever you know you want to put on it, okay? It's whatever title you want to give it, and it's a good place to be.
Yeah, I think I can control
yeah.
it too, but you know, but it's sometimes it kind of squeaks out of you, something inappropriate or something a little bit off, and it's just like
I'd probably think it was funny.
I think it was funny, and of course. A lot of things that I think are funny. A lot of people, some people don't get. I mean, they laugh, and then all of a sudden they're crying, and I'm like, "What happened?" You know. Mm-hmm. So it's a double edged sword humor, and I appreciate that about you. And I know we were talking earlier about your cut up and all that. So that's something you and I have in common.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think it's good for the soul, though, Rob, okay? When you get to a certain place.
Yeah, oh, laughing. Just
you know,
laughing.
My God, it is.
And, you know, thank God I married my wife, Kate, in 2012, and she's one of the few women or few people, really, that can make me just laugh, like, down at the gut level. We just have, you know, I think she had some neglect or whatever. She has an appreciation for some of the dark humor that, you know, the way I can see the world. And I, you know, so I've had to cultivate optimism. And, you know, I teach, you know, art, and I do something, you know, I call it The Power of Positive Painting. That's my book. I just published a book about how to draw and paint. And, you know, you have to figure out how to direct your life in ways that are going to be move you forward rather than just hold you back. And even despite what's happened is my body is, you know, I have chronic pain. I'm on disability now because you know I just it's that you call it that monster. That demon, that thing, is kind of became part of my, became part of my mental processing, you know, my DNA, you know, it's like part of me has this in me, and I've chased it around in different systems in my body, and it's just now it's kind of lodged into my back and neck, and it's just like chronic pain. I had some surgeries done and for injuries, whatnot.
You have fibromyalgia?
And it's just,
I mean, is that what you have?
No, I don't have that. No, I don't have. We're still trying to figure out. I'm going to a rheumatologist to see. But, you know, obviously, you know, we can treat the symptoms of it. But, you know, in my mind, I kind of know what it is. It's just I can't – it's something, you know, you can't just – here's the thing. Before it becomes part of – like I allowed it to become part of my persona. Like you said, it's not who we are. It's not our identity. But I allowed it to become that for me in my early 20s and 30s. And, you know, once I made that decision, or it made me, it's been kind of hell to try to get a handle on the pain and whatnot, because that's mostly, I think, caused from the mental, the PTSD and the anxiety and depression that results from dealing with this trauma. So, you know, I have kids. I went ahead and had kids thinking, okay, I'm going to break this cycle and protect my kids, and they're never going to have what happened to me. I'm never going to allow them to have that happen. So sure enough, I'm talking to my kids when they're, you know, young about this, to, you know, never be alone with a man or a person, or never, you know, all the rules that you practice, common good sense practices, to, you know, to protect them. But, you know, right under my nose, the guy across the street tried to get my daughter to put her hand on his genitals. She pulled it away and got out of the pool, and we went home and she told her that this had happened. You know, like, I'm right there. I mean, the audacity of a guy who would try that. And of course he denied it, and, you know, and Mary's like, well, there's no justice. I mean, he didn't, you know, we called the police, and the police said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's your word against his. And of course we can't take the word of a little girl.
Whoa, stop there. Stop there. Hold on, honey.
Yeah.
You just blew me away. Yeah, you just blew me away. Wait a minute. You said you called the police, and they, or you went to the police department, and they said there was nothing they could do. It is what it is.
It didn't happen because she pulled her hand away. Because it didn't happen, there's no crime. So, and you know, I'm just glad that I spoke with Mary. She has NVLD, which makes she sort of has a disability, kind of on the spectrum. So she, I made it really clear to her very over and over again throughout her life to what to look for, what to watch out for. You know, if somebody's telling you all these nice things, you know, be careful, because they might, you know, they might be grooming you. I mean, I she knew all this, so we're going into it. So when this happened, she knew what to do. She knew to pull her hand out and excuse herself and tell someone immediately. And so... you know, all I can do is, Mary, I am so proud of you. You are so brave and so courageous. Look what you stopped this from happening, you know. But we're kind of ostracized in the neighborhood because, the neighbor, you know, has claimed that Mary's a crazy little girl. You got to watch out for her. She's going to get in trouble, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is the society we live in. I'm in the South, of course. You know, there's a lot of... mentality. But here's this sweet little girl, no guile. You know, my daughter has no guile. She's a complete innocent. And fortunately, she's still that way. And we succeeded in protecting her. But, you know, it's very precarious as a parent. As a survivor of abuse, being a parent is, you know, really stressful.
Absolutely. I have anger, okay? I have to deal with anger. And I would want to pick up a baseball bat and go over and go, bang! That's what, you know, this is how I feel.
You want to do it, but you know, you can't really get away with that.
No, I probably, because she didn't actually make contact, then I probably would have been in trouble for hitting him in the head or somewhere else. I don't know. So,
absolutely. No, that would have been, we don't know, but the best thing to do, this was over a year ago, and so he called over to her last week and asked her to come over and talk, and she just turned away and came over here. And so we went over there to talk, and I was, you know, she was hoping that he was going to confess to her and make everything okay, better, whatever, say, I've got a problem, I'm sorry this happened, you know. That's what you want to hear from a perpetrator. But
right.
No, he said, I would never do something like that. You know, he was good Southern boy, and just, you know, made a big a bunch of denials. And I said, well, you know, it's your word against hers, and I'm afraid I'm going to stand by my daughter in this, and, you know, even if we're alone, completely alone in the community, we're standing together, you know, and
that's
what we need more of. And of course, you know, the thing is, you know, you're not rewarded for standing up, you know, so standing up for what's right. You can become, you know, ostracized and, you know, called names and bullied and ignored and whatever. So there's a, we have a long way to go in the society that we're living in before we can really
I agree with that. Although, more men are talking about it now. I mean, you're here tonight, and we've had quite a few, now. You know, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing because, you know, many times when you're brought up, now this may not have happened in your family, but I think you did say it got swept under the rug at one point or whatever. But many times, you know, men are not supposed to talk about this stuff. They're just simply not.
Exactly.
Because you have to man up and you have to be strong, you know, and you can't have feelings like women would have, you know. That would be a no-no. Yeah. You're supposed to be macho.
Yeah.
And that's just not right. So all the things that you dealt with, okay, I'm going back a little bit here because we have plenty of time, but there's people listen a lot on the computers a lot. They like to do that. Some people don't like to be on the show because they're bashful or maybe they don't want to show emotion, you know what I'm saying? And so there's a problem with that at times. Other times we have a lot of people. You just never know how it's going to go. But listen. What I'm getting at to here is something that they should be listening to also. You know, when you're growing up as a kid and you haven't been taught, now you're teaching your daughter, you're teaching your children what to do, what not to do, how to handle this. You're teaching them about their bodies and you're teaching them, you know, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And also, too, you know, teenagers can also be perpetrators. You know, they can, you know, but they hide it from their peers because they don't want their peers to know this. And, you know, quite frankly, then they do end up acting out sooner or later. They absolutely do. And they turn into, as we say it and call it, and what it is pedophiles, all right? Now, in your case, what happened with you, you must have suffered horribly. I mean, I can – to have this nut, I'm going to call him a nut, all right? You know, not so far away, and being sort of like the pillar of society because he was a doctor. Come on, he's a doctor, right?
Right.
You know, and who? Yeah. And so, you know.
Talk about authority issues. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, people are going to look up to him. They're not going to look down on him. They're going to think there may be something wrong with you if you, you know, pursue this or whatever. Because he is a doctor.
I believe that was the unspoken truth. It was something that I was making trouble. I'm the troublemaker. You know, Mary, my daughter, was the troublemaker. And, you know, that's the way people, you know, are. If you speak out and you say, hey, you know, this isn't right, you're the troublemaker.
We have to be troublemakers.
Yeah.
We have to be.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you why. All right. Now, I was living in this house with a pedophile. And he told me he was going to kill me and all this other stuff, whatever. I have a long story of my own. Most of us do. So, and yeah. Of course, I was horrified of this man, horrified of him. And he was mm-hmm. my uncle, but not by blood. It was an aunt of mine who had married this nut. So anyway, mm-hmm. You know, I kept my mouth shut for a very, very long time, and I waited for the doorknob to turn when it wasn't quite light out. And if that was turning, I knew he was coming in, okay? And I knew what I was going to go through, all right? My sexual abuse started at the age of 6, okay?
Oh, my God.
So, yes. So, but we don't take yardsticks here on because abuse is abuse, and trauma is trauma. I don't care if you're 6, 12, 14, or whatever you are. It's trauma.
Yeah.
So anyway, I finally got the guts up to tell on this guy. And no one did anything. Now, I had been abused many times by this nut. And no one mm-hmm. did anything in the family. No one. But he made the mistake of going to the little girl next door. And her father came in and caught him. And he beat the living daylights out of him. Okay?
Oh, God.
The man couldn't even walk, all right? So when I heard this story, I was feeling a little bit better, okay? Just a little bit better.
Yeah.
But I want to say something to everyone out there because they feel like doing that too. And I have this other side of me where I can get really, really angry, okay, if I think it's justified.
Yeah.
So,
triggered, I get angry, right.
Absolutely. My point in saying this is the fact that, okay, he got very beaten, and he didn't leave the house for a month or something, from what I understand, because he had broken bones, he had bruises, and all this other stuff. He wasn't going to go to the police. Look what he'd done. You know, he can't say, hey, this guy beat me up, because look what he had done. He got caught.
Yeah.
So they moved down Florida. And what happened was he continued his evil ways. I mean, the man, when you're a pedophile, you had asked something mm-hmm. before with this man who had attacked you. You can be sure that man has attacked many, because studies do show that anywhere is between 124 to 128 times a pedophile before the first time getting caught. Now, that means maybe 10 times with one kid, maybe 5 times with another kid. You do the math. It doesn't matter how you put the equation of the numerical system here, because it's mm-hmm. been 124 to 128 times, many times, that the assault took place, the crimes against children, okay, because that's what it is, crimes against children. And then they get caught.
Yeah.
And then they're only tier ones because it's the first time that they got caught. You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Now, so this man who, you know, gave you all this grief, and justifiably so, you have grief, and your body screams out. That's why I mm-hmm. asked if you had fibromyalgia, because many people who have been sexually abused, or abuse of any kind, sexual, physical, mental, emotional, or all of the abuses, neglect, like I did, all of them. I
mm-hmm.
have fibromyalgia. And I'm going to tell you something. There were two doctors on the Internet, and this is important for some people out there to go, fibromyalgia.
Yeah,
all right, let me tell you something. There were two doctors on, and they weren't trying to sell any products at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were speaking about fibromyalgia. The one doctor had it, the other doctor didn't. The doctor who had fibromyalgia came from an abusive background. Okay? He didn't
mm-hmm.
want to exactly tell his story at the time, but he paints a picture. You're an artist. I had a good uncle that was an artist. He had 2 studios. He was very good. And in Martha's
mm-hmm.
Vineyard, to be exactly. But anyway, he paints a picture, and so that you know what happened to him without actually saying, yes, he was sexually abused, yes, he was physically abused, yes, 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 yes to all the abuses. He has fibromyalgia. So when you speak about your body aching, you know, your back, you're this, you're that, whatever, I believe, from what I've been taught and trained, that you, I'm not going to say you have fibromyalgia, you haven't been diagnosed with that. But, you know, your
right.
body's
I'm looking into
out.
It. But it's interesting you mention it, mm-hmm. because, you know, I am actually, I have an appointment to see a rheumatologist
mm-hmm.
to look
mm-hmm.
into something that sort of spiked in my recent blood test. But it's fascinating, you know, to try to see if there's any kind of a connection. But it's pretty clear from what you're saying and from what others have said in the research I've done is that
mm-hmm.
it takes its toll, because you're holding on to all this bullshit, you know, you're holding on to all these strange
yeah.
guilt and these feelings of, you know, self-defilement, you know, you're just, you know, you don't think you're good enough. And these are all natural occurrences that come out
mm-hmm.
of abuse. I mean,
absolutely.
The abuse, the actual event is you know, it's a you know, happens like that. The rest of your life, you're spending trying to figure out how to make sense of it, and you know, and it's of course, how do you make sense of something that is absolutely senseless? I mean, you know, who would do something like that to a child? Well, there's lots of people in this world who maybe have attraction to children, but do not act on it. I think that's, you know, it's, I don't know. There's, what do you think about, have you heard about those? I mean, some of these people are, who are pedophiles, who are seeking treatment and being helped to try to deal with those kinds of feelings. We're living in a world where we've got to try everything and anything to stop this epidemic, you know, this pandemic of child abuse. We've got to go from both sides of the deal, prevention, but, you know, includes stopping people before they, 124 offenses or whatever. I mean, it's unbelievable how many times this guy that did me could have done it to other people. You know,
well, let me tell you something.
Stop it.
I'm going to ignore it. There's something's trying to get through, but I'm just going to ignore it. What they'll leave a message, I hope. But anyway, the point is this. You said,
well, bring
you
them
said
on.
A whole
I have something to say.
No. You just said a whole mouthful. You really did.
Yeah, I did.
And that's good. No. That's good. Because you see, there's all kinds of studies. I'll give you an example. And I tell people this. I had called a place down in southern Jersey, heading towards southern Jersey. And they housed teenage pedophiles. Now, these are kids that had been caught sexually abusing younger children. And all kinds, I wanted the lady to come on the show, but she hung up on me. I started asking her questions because I wanted to know, and this will answer something that you just said. She wanted to know if there was help for pedophiles, or I wanted to know, rather, if there was help for pedophiles. So I'm asking her these questions, you know, key questions. I've got this lady who's a director who works with, you know, and has staff who works with teenage pedophiles. By the time
mm-hmm.
you're 13 to 15 years old, you know you're different, okay?
Yeah.
And you start realizing, I mean realizing that you are a pedophile, but you may not have a name for it at that age, but you know that you have, mm-hmm. you know, you want to make younger children your prey, and I use that as P-R-E-Y, not P-R-A-Y, it's prey.
Sure.
And but you hide it because you don't want your peers to know this because, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But some can't control themselves. So then, therefore, they do, and maybe they'll be a babysitter. Maybe they'll go babysit some kid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And touchy-feely, and here we go, all right? So,
yeah.
And then these children turn into, of course, adult pedophiles, and a lot of children don't tell. We know this. The stats are very high that children a lot of times don't tell because they've been groomed in such a way that if you do kill, I'll kill you, I'll kill your cat, I'll kill your dog,
sure.
or, you know, no one's going to believe you, you're nothing but a snotty-nosed kid, you know, and all
sure.
this other stuff.
Same,
or you're
same
a troublemaker.
That come naturally. It comes, you know,
yes.
that grooming process, it comes natural. These people are also
mm-hmm.
sociopaths. And
mm-hmm, absolutely.
There's, you know, but there's a difference between somebody who has an impulse and somebody who acts on it. And I do believe, and I guess I have firsthand experience with a boy. I'm not going to name him or define my relationship. But he, you know, when he was 11 or 12, acted out sexually on his on a 9 or 10 year old cousin, and that got him. The cousin told him, and so now this boy was in therapy for a year and 2 years, whatever, and got all kinds of help and learning how to, you know, use executive functioning, how to learn how to control those impulses. So that, you know, that can be conditioned, I guess, or managed, you know, just because that's a proclivity that this boy had doesn't necessarily mean that he's damned for life. I know that we're not here talking about pedophiles and getting help for pedophiles, but it's an interesting digression in the conversation to look at it from that perspective, because if we don't start finding ways to help people that are, you know, kind of leaning in that direction, sociopathy, you know, the no conscience, that they don't think that it's wrong for them to get what they want. And, you know, this boy had to learn how to control and manage those thoughts. And it's not just sex, it's wants this, you want that, you know, you can't have everything you want. I mean, we all have to learn that.
Well, it's called impulsivity, that what you're referring to.
Yeah.
It's called impulsivity. With the studies that I've seen and also what I've been taught, what I've learned, so far, I don't want to be a negative person here, but so far, they feel like they are wired differently, you know, and it's very hard. And also, too, once we are attacked, assaulted, crimes against children,
yes,
we become wired differently, too, because our brain, and you know, works in such a way that, it tries to, like, hide, you know, certain things that we're starting to feel, you know, the fright, the freeze, then the fright, you know, and all this other stuff,
mm-hmm,
that people go through. And so we're wired also differently. So they haven't found anything yet. Speaking about Oprah, I wish you'd seen this, and then you'd have a better understanding, too. But Oprah, one of her last shows that she had nothing more on her stage and there was no audience, all right, nothing but pedophiles. Now, Oprah, too, had been abused as a child. I think it was my uncle or grandfather. I don't know which one. I forget. But anyway, she had these pedophiles.
That show.
Well, she had let everybody else hear too. She had pedophiles on her stage, and she was asking them very specific questions, and they ranged from age, I'm going to say, well, in their 30s, all right? The guy wasn't very old, the first one, in the 30s. And the oldest one was, I think, in his 60s or maybe even closer to 70, all right? So one of the questions that she posed to them, okay, is, are you, now that you've had therapy, these guys have had therapy, are you safe to be around children now? Not one could say yes. Not one.
Well, you know, that's true, right? It's unfortunate. Because, you know, children are wonderful, and if you can't be around them because that happens, that's sad. It's just a sad thing, you know, and I mean, it's hard to feel sympathy for somebody who has those feelings, but I have a great admiration for somebody, and like this boy that I'm talking about, who can have had that experience and learn how to manage it and learn how to control those feelings and not put himself in harm's way. You know, I you know, I always make sure if I go to a doctor's appointment, I leave the door open a crack, and I tell my kids to do the same. It's not a bad, you know, these are practices. You just don't get yourself alone in situations where you are going to get in trouble. And
absolutely. And of course, you just said doctor, right? And that's what that, you know, that's who, you know, assaulted you, the doctor.
Sure. And it's a trigger,
it doesn't matter
sure.
what walk of life you come from, okay? I mean, look at what happened. I use this at times, but look at Penn State. Look what happened, okay, over there.
Yeah.
All right?
Unbelievable.
And here there were so many kids. I think they were all boys, weren't they? I think they were. I could be wrong on that, but I think they were all boys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, he was a troop monster. I mean, all these kids over all the years, and these children, from what I understand, from what I remember, they came from backgrounds where they were, you know, were poor and so forth. And so he had a group of boys that, you know, he'd make, try to make them feel special, do this, do that. And here he was, you know, well, he was having sex with them.
Yeah.
Plain English, you know, that's just the way it was.
I mean, this is,
you know,
this is that's the thing, you know, if you get somebody who's a sociopath, and they don't have any kind of regulation, and they get themselves into, you know, these people tend to find themselves as teachers or authorities or doctors or priests and whatnot. They are drawn to those kinds of professions where they're going to have access to children. And,
right.
you know, I would tell that boy who was struggling at age 11 or 12 not to go into those kind of professions, just simply, you know, choose another field, because you don't want to put yourself in that situation where you're going to be tempted. So anyway, this is a really fascinating digression. I don't know if you guys ever talk about this kind of thing, but I think it's interesting. You know, like I say, I've had experiences on sort of both sides of the wall, trying to help somebody who was struggling with those feelings, and of course helping myself and others who have been victimized by these people. And it's very easy to say, yes, they're monsters. They must all be, you know, destroyed, killed, beaten, whatever they, you know, the fantasies you think about. And those don't go away. But, you know, you have to have empathy for the fact that, you know, people are struggling with all kinds of things in this world, you know. And not everybody's completely innocent. You know, I mean, I did my share of womanizing, acting out, you know, because of the abuse. You know, I could always blame it on that, but it doesn't make it okay, you know, I never, you know, committed any crimes, but I mean, there's bad behaviors that we have all experienced, and nobody talks about that because we want to think of ourselves as the innocent, you know, the innocent lamb that was led to slaughter. But the fact is that has an effect on people, and that's why I said at the beginning of the conversation, it's generational, and you know, has to be stopped at every turn, every opportunity. It has to be spoken about and called out and talked about openly, that these feelings that you're having, if you've been abused, these feelings they can take all kinds of forms. And you were talking about your anger. Drinking, using external intoxicants, whatever, to try to cover the horror. You know, I think of Marlon Brando.
I was trying to get rid of my panic attacks.
The horror.
I was trying to get rid of my panic attacks. Or, you know, I mean, this is what I was doing. Look, I couldn't even go to school. I mean, I would go to school.
Yeah.
All right. And I ended up walking out of school when I was 16, and I took my GED because I had panic so badly that I couldn't stand up in front of my peers. I felt like, well, I was neglected at home. I didn't have proper clothing. I didn't have this. I didn't have that. The normal things that girls should have, okay?
Sure.
And there was a lot of bullying going on, and that's probably where a lot of my anger, you know, came from too, because if someone bothered me, I'd punch him in the nose.
Sure.
No, that's the way I am. You know, oh yeah, take this, bang. That's what I did. You know, it made me feel better. I don't care what they felt like. I know what they made me feel like. So Yeah, this is for you. So, you know, but, you know, as we go along, as we go along.
I mean, you just think of all the suffering and how it takes, how it manifests itself, how it's perpetuating, you know, someone kicks a dog, the dog bites somebody, that person gets bitten and they hate dogs and they, you know, whatever. It's just this ongoing cycle of misery and despair that people have. And it's where does it end? The only way it can stop is when people call it out, to talk about the feelings that, you know, we have and the bad behaviors that I've experienced. I mean, I really tried to think of myself as some saint because I was this victim and I felt so sorry for myself and I wanted everyone else to know that I'm a you know, but it was like, oh, no, I'm not a victim anymore. Now I'm a survivor. And, you know, and that's
we're
a
not
badge
people.
Of honor.
Ross,
yes,
we're
but we're
perfect
not perfect people.
People.
Yes.
We have to
and,
look
you know,
at ourselves. See, I teach people this. I teach this. Yes, I do. And I'll tell you why. Okay. Otherwise, people do start saying, well, they get so self-righteous. Look, when I was out on the streets, okay, because I ended up out on the streets, one of my abusers was home. I told you, as many people that abused me. So I'd rather be out on the streets. I made friends with, they actually looked after me out on the streets because I was the youngest. Okay. And, okay, they gave me my alcohol, and I drank, believe me, like a fish. And I popped some Quaalude, too. Now, the combination of those two is very deadly, all right? I'm meant to be here. I very much believe in God, and I know that God saved my life. I know this. And somehow you just know these things, all right? You know it, I know it, and a lot of people know it.
Well, you're here talking. God has saved your life. You have literally survived.
Absolutely. And I ended up joining a prayer group that had counselors. It was a huge prayer group, and around over 200 people. And there were counselors there, and they helped me. And I did a battery of tests. I found out I wasn't stupid. In fact, they wanted me to become a counselor. They put me in all different positions and different types of jobs. And that all worked well, you know, absolutely. So, you know, and they sent me to school, for God's sake, which I didn't want to do. I still had my flask in my pocket. Oh, yes, I did, because I figured if I have to get up in front of my peers, even in, you know, I went to Princeton. They sent me to Princeton along with a nurse. I was from detox, and I worked there. And but they wanted me to have a little more under my belt. Now, they didn't know that I'm an alcoholic. I stopped drinking in 1981. Right. But the point of it is that flask, I hadn't stopped drinking yet. So, you know, I would take a couple of swigs before I had to get up and you know, talk to people, you know, do, you know, give you know, sort of like a book report or a thesis or whatever you want to call it. The point is I didn't have the courage to do that yet, because when we're hurt so badly as a child, it takes away our self-confidence. It, when we feel like maybe we were a little bit responsible, look, time after time after time, I must be doing something wrong. A lot of people think that way. We're targeted, you know. But the truth of the matter.
Our society it gears us to believe that it's our fault. If you're suffering, if you're poor, it's your fault. You didn't work hard enough. You know, nobody works harder than a poor person. I'll tell you that. And people who are struggling are working really hard to make it and to survive, and not to digress, not to take you from your subject here, but just wanted to throw that in there.
No, that's right. That's right. But we have to remember too, though. Look, I did things that I can look back at, and I had to forgive myself for, because my actions were not very good. Now, there are other kids out there and people out there older than me that that's how I got my booze and everything. But, you know, they did far worse things than I did. I saw two kids die in front of me because they OD'd. They were using heroin. But they wouldn't even let me near heroin. Okay, no way. Because I was like their little sister. That's the way they treated me. I was lucky, actually, right? And I could go back home. They didn't have a home. I was in a better place than them. So yeah. I would sneak back home, and I would take food. I'd sneak into the house. I didn't want to see my mother and stepfather, certainly not my brother. So I would wait until the a.m. hours, and I would go in, and I'd take certain things. And no one said anything. No one went looking for me anyway. But I would take it back to the group, my group, okay, of people that I was hanging out with. My pack, mm-hmm. exactly.
Yeah.
And, boy, they were real happy when I went home, all right? You know, I came from wealth. I wasn't a poor person.
Right.
And that's what makes the whole thing so ugly. Yeah. See, it doesn't matter whether you're poor, whether you're rich, or whether you're in between. It doesn't matter. Sexual abuse happens to children of all ages and backgrounds. That's just the way it is. But still and all, we're not perfect people. We have to look at ourselves and work on the things on our own, you know, areas that need to be, you know, looked at. Like I have a terrible temper if I lose it.
Yeah.
And I will get involved, all right? That's just the way
so,
that I am.
So far, Carol, you've done very well tonight, by the way, on your temper.
Well, thank you so much. you haven't lost your temper once. Well, we're getting along very well. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. We're having a good show here. Yes, we are.
Thanks.
And we're teaching people, this, Rob. You see, we're teaching people. This is
exactly.
good.
Exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of being able to forgive yourself, you know, for me, it helped to be able to have God forgive me, because it's easier to say God is forgiving me than it is sometimes for ourselves. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to forgive ourselves because maybe I should have done this or I could have done that. If I'd only done this, this wouldn't have happened, and then I wouldn't be in the predicament that I am and hurting other people. So all this stuff is like this, it's this cycle that we have to stamp it out. And again, I'll say it one more time to make sure it hits home for everybody, is that the way to break the cycle is to talk about it, is to get with somebody that you can trust and talk, start the conversation. And, you know, this, what is it? The opposite of expression is depression. So depression, the remedy for depression is to express, to put something out there. For me, it was very helpful that I'm a creative. So I can write, and I can paint, and I can do all these things. And when I'm doing those things, I'm not thinking about my troubles, or I'm not thinking about, you know, all the guilt or whatever, any of the feelings I'm having. In fact, I don't even feel pain when I'm, you know, doing my work. That's why I'm so prolific.
Yeah, well,
I do
that's okay. That's good. That's good.
Well, you talk.
Yeah, let me tell you something.
Life or death.
Well, we all have our talents, okay? I don't mean to talk over you, but you are a little echoey, okay? I don't know what's going on here. I have new phones. Maybe they're no good. I don't know. But
you sound terrific.
Well, I don't know. You're echoey yet. But anyway, okay, I can hear you for sure. There's no problem. It's just a little echoey.
I'm just that.
So when I think you stop a sentence, you're still going on. I didn't hear you, all right? So, but anyway... It'll work out fine in the archives. People will hear this beautifully, you'll see. But anyway, the point is this, that we didn't deserve any of this that happened to us. We all have our stories.
Right.
Okay. And we did not deserve to be abused in any size, shape, way, or form. And as for, you know, the people who abuse this, or you may say, well, they have these deficiencies, they have this, they have that. Well, maybe it's in the family line. It wasn't in my family line that I know of. Okay, my brother was the only offender. And I'm talking about only my family line. I didn't know of anybody else that was out being a pedophile. And but I think, you know, I don't, as it turned out, I found out that my father wasn't even my real father anyway. So there's different bloods there that I don't know about. I learned it through Ancestry. I had it done, my DNA.
Yeah.
So
I wonder how much of that is, you know, true, you know, whether it's passed down through your bloodline and all that. But I think it's passed down through, you know, behaviors through people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they learn the behavior. I think that there are people who are born with a certain level of sociopathy. And those people, combined with a predilection for children, is you know, that's a recipe for a disaster, because those are the people who are going out there and doing all that spending. So people, you know, we have to teach. I mean, I had to teach my kids right and wrong. I mean, like, you wouldn't believe. My daughter was a little girl. She'd pick up a kitten and start swinging it by the tail. You know, I'm like, what?
Oh, no.
You can't do that.
I have a cat. I don't like that.
I know. People aren't necessarily born having empathy and having a sense of right and wrong. Some people aren't born curious. Some people are just not naturally, creative, whatever it is. Everybody's different. And, I mean, having kids, I've had to learn, you know, different styles of different ways of being that people have that are completely foreign to me. You would think that because they're my kids, they would be kind of like me, but, you know, they're not. and that's all good. They're beautiful in their own ways. But they had to learn. My kids had to learn basic right from wrong, and it has to be practiced all the time. And, I don't think a lot of kids are getting it, because I'll tell you what, it's exhausting as a parent to try to teach your children how to function without hurting people, and, you know, how to actually have empathy. And it doesn't come natural to some people, you know?
No, it doesn't.
Having said that, it's just because everybody's somewhere on some kind of spectrum with their sociopathy and with their sexual predilections, you know, whatever the thing is, people have to learn how to, you know, not hurt others.
That's right.
Bottom line.
Not hurt others. You said it right there.
You just got to stop doing hurtful things. And, you know, it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort on yourself. And as a parent, you know, it takes a lot to get your kids to really be, you know, human.
Well, you know, I think, like with my brother, I know for a fact that he didn't stop, okay? Because my daughter brought over, we went to the farm, my mother and stepfather. I always were with people that were flower growers, and they were very, very fortunate to be very good flower growers, and they were quite wealthy. Either you're wealthy, you don't make it. You know, with flowers, it's, you know, something. There's nothing in between, you know. So, but they did very well. And the point is, my daughter and myself and my son and his friend had gone to the farm, and my brother was there. And I looked out the window, and there was my brother. He had my daughter's friend down on the ground, and he was fondling her. The poor kid was screaming. Right?
Oh, my God.
So I said to my mother, I said, look at this. So she went to the window, and she said, now, cut that out. That's it. So what did he do? He took the poor kid around the other side of the house. Now, they had 35 acres, okay? They had 35 acres and a huge house. So we thought that was the end of it. I thought he'd cut it out, right? And so I went to the other side of the house, and I looked out that door, and he was still doing it.
Yeah. Well, just out of curiosity, I know you don't want to talk about it necessarily, but did he seek help? Did he ever acknowledge, recognize that he had a problem?
No. I confronted him
once.
And you know what? You know what he said to me? You liked it. I said, I beg your pardon? He said, you liked it. I said, no, I didn't. I hated it, and I was scared to death of you, because he'd get this maniacal look on his face. And he didn't drink, by the way, do drugs or anything else, but he had this, this maniacal type of look on his face. And and he scared me. He was 5 years my senior. He's still alive.
Sure.
I have people look it up at times, but he's still alive. And even when I wrote my book, I didn't want to name him, certainly not name him, but I didn't even want to go into it because I was so still carrying that fear of him.
Yeah. It doesn't go away, right? The fear is still there. You don't even know what you're afraid of anymore after a while.
No, it's just, it's big and bad and bold.
Yeah,
so,
yes.
I was afraid that if you ever read my book, I always say you'd have to be a little bit of a mental midget. Excuse me for putting it that way, but, you know, that's the way I speak. I'm a New Yorker. I sound New York. I can't help it. But anyway, here's this. If he read that book, he would come up from where he is. To me, he's under a stone, as far as I'm considered, a rock, like they say. But he would come up, and he'd do something. He'd do damage. He would.
Yeah.
And the way I wrote the book, though, I worded it in such a way without actually saying, and that's why I'm saying you'd have to not be very bright to not understand what I was getting at, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to. So he was a chapter in my book, but I didn't go into too much detail because I want to keep living. One time I wanted to kill myself, and I tried, and I got stopped. I got caught. All right, so I'm glad I got caught today. But I suffered from suicidal ideations for many years.
Yeah.
Because of all the you know, it compounded all the, you know, time after time after time after time. And I didn't care if I lived or died. And I really didn't care. I didn't care.
Yeah.
So today,
well,
my God,
I'm glad you lived.
I'm glad I'm here, too. I can talk
and
to
so
you.
And so are a
yes,
lot
I
of
can.
Other people. A lot of people who are benefiting from your ministry and the work that you're doing, and it's important, and you need to hear that, know it, that you know that you're whole and complete, you know, as you are, and so this is something we all need to know and hear from other people who who've suffered as well. So it probably means more. People care about you. Cares about you. If you're listening, you know, someone cares about you.
Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate that. But you see, we've walked the walk and we can talk the talk. And after many years of doing this type of work, I mean, I've been on NASCA for almost 12 years. It'll be this summer, 12 years, or spring, actually. And I worked all different kinds of jobs in the past because I have two children, and their father was very negligent and an alcoholic and an abusive one. I married my father. That's what I did, the one that I thought was my father.
Sure.
So this is what we do so often. How are you? I mean, you're happily married. You're a lucky man.
Marriage wasn't so lucky, but I had kids with the first marriage, and my wife, Kate, is just absolutely beautiful with the kids, and her own kids are all grown. My kids are, you know, teenagers, and she's, you know, got a second crack at motherhood, and she's doing great. And it's been working out very well. And I think, you know, you learn after that first marriage. You know, everyone's got to get that first marriage out of the way, you know.
Well, I know what you mean, but hey, look, my first marriage, the guy had a Harley. I was happy with that. He had a Cadillac, and he'd take me into New York. He took me to Sardi's. He'd buy me clothing and things like this. I thought I died and went to heaven. All right?
Yeah.
I met this guy who would pull the chair out for me. All kind, you know, when we went into restaurants, a total gentleman, and he was so good looking. He looked like he was a movie star. And he turned out to be a monster. And he didn't even like his kids, you know. It's very bad, very sad. Now, we're at the end of the show. I mean, it's getting close. But I want to say something here to you. I'm looking at your bio here. It says here, his recent dramatic reading of a poem from the perspective of the perpetrator might be played during the show. If you would like to read that, it's okay.
Oh no, that was back then. I did this the second time I've been on your show, and that was the first time I think I was going to read some of that. It's not fresh in my mind that poem. But you know, speaking of poems, you know, I've written lots of poetry, and again, this is a part of the process for me. This is kind of taking the different perspectives and trying to imagine, you know, from the perpetrator's point of view, seeing it, hearing his words, and then make, as the creator, getting that perpetrator to say what I really needed to hear, which is, I'm sorry I did this to you.
Right.
You
right.
know?
And you know
I,
what?
I was terrible to do this.
That.
And you're not going to get that. But, you know, as an artist,
no.
And as a person who's working hard at being creative and trying to heal, you know, you can reframe, you have to in some ways. You have to learn how to, because in order to forgive somebody, there has to be some kind of apology. And without forgiveness, you're stuck with this horrible thing inside you, and you've got to learn, you've got to let it. To learn how to let it go, and letting it go, you know, you can't really completely let it go, but, you know, forgiveness is something you have to practice on a daily basis in little small ways and in big ways, you know, forgiving that person. I was a courtroom sketch artist for the Dylann Roof trial, you know, the guy who killed those 9 people, beautiful people at the Emanuel, you know, here in Charleston, and So I sat through that whole trial, and I could see this kid, you know, his brain kind of working and turning during the trial, and, you know, he wouldn't look at the people, and, you know, he was a scary guy because he looked like a kind of a likable, kind of a nice guy, but inside there was this cold sociopathic, you know, there's no remorse or guilt, and, you know, that's, you know, someone who's born that way is, you know, it's a terrible thing. And to watch that guy, mm-hmm. I'm an actor as well, so I've played, you know, bad guys, whatever. And, you know, mm-hmm. you think, I'm going to be a really bad guy, and I'm going to talk like this, and I'm going to run around here. You know what? Bad guys are really nice. These are some of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And this is the terrible thing. The people who groom you are really charming. I mean, the guy who groomed me, that doctor, he was as charming a person as you'll ever meet, you know. They're not all nasty, grody-looking, scummy people. That's the thing you got to watch for when you're looking out for your kids. It's the people who are really nice. You know, like I said, the nicer the demeanor, sometimes demeanor they are. So.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Like you were
and
just,
you know,
yeah,
but what you're saying here, though, sociopaths, okay, and psychopaths are two different animals. The sociopath usually is environmental. I used to work at Greystone Psychiatric, so I know this, is usually environmental. The psychopath, which you're really more referring to, I think, by the way you're speaking, has absolutely, utterly no empathy at all. The sociopath will have a small circle of people and can fall in love. He can have a little family, and he can feel if one of his own, like in his pack, okay, gets killed, say they're bikers and they're gang members. The psychopath, on the other hand, has nothing. But he learns by looking at people how to behave. And when he does get married, okay, he has no real feeling for anyone in his family. He's just like playing a role. He's like being an actor. Right?
Yeah.
An actor in life.
And, I know there's a distinction between the psychopath mm-hmm. and the sociopath. And I'm not a psychiatrist or whatever, but I have drawn, you know, attracted whatever lots of sociopaths in my life. They just seem to like. They glam onto someone like me because, you know, they know they can play us. And there's a tremendous con game. And it's interesting, the sociopaths that I've known are very emotional. They get very upset. Like the guy across the street, we were talking to him just the other day, as I was telling you, and he was more concerned. He says, I just don't want, you know, Mary to not like me. I don't want people to not like me. He actually said it. And that they'll do anything, those people, to be liked and to not get in trouble. That's all they care about. They just want to be able to do what they want to whoever they want and have no consequences. And this is the world we're living in right now. This, people feel like they can, you know, it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It's just I got to get what I want. And if I can't get it, I'm going to make your life miserable. Just because I want people you have to like me. Yeah. Well, we're going to end the show. I thought we had all the time in the world.
Well, I know, and I could like talk to you for another 2 hours. That's how I feel. But I'm getting the cue in my ear. We had a wonderful show, and you know, let me tell you something. A lot of people were listening, and they hear you, and they hear what you're saying, and you know, and they respect you. They do, absolutely.
Thank you.
And I would love it if you'd come on.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yes. And we usually wait about a year before we have someone come on, or maybe 9 months, whatever, you know, to tell their story again. So I have to end the show, and I feel bad because I want to keep talking to you. But
we can talk again. We'll touch base in 9 months to a year after I've had, you know, gestated for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
We can
okay. We
can talk again, and the story is ongoing. And I appreciate your having me on, and it's been great. And I hope all you people out there, if you're listening, that you get the help you need or talk to people. Just talk and just put it out there. Just get something going.
That's right. Good for you. And I'm proud of you. Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
I have to end the show, honey. I have to because I don't know if we're being recorded anymore. Okay. So
okay.
We'll have you on again as soon as we can because I like your style. How's that? Yes, I do.
I appreciate you too. Okay, Carol.
Okay. Good night now. Thanks. God bless everyone out there. Watch your back. Watch your neighbor's back. And we'll see you soon. Okay. Good night now. Thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
No tomorrow.
All right.
'Cause that dawn was good. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Log Talk Radio.
Okay. So are you singing and dancing or what?
I do know this.